Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Hey, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here, another week. Ryan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Another great weekend. Got to go flying, actually.
Heck yeah. Yeah, it's actually same here. I got to fly the Bonanza this weekend. We're on the mainland this week, so doing some work on the short-term rental, actually.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. I landed in Seattle, and I timed it. My timing landing in Seattle was faster to fly the airplane up to Anacortes for a real estate meetup that I was a keynote speaker at, which was really fun to fly and land at an airport 10 minutes away. And
oh, heck yeah.
Sounds super like fun. Oh, can I admit, too, that I actually, when I flew the plane back to Renton, we actually flew the airplane down to minimums, which and a single engine piston, that's pretty rare for me to do. But man, that plane handles it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Like a champ. I mean, holy cow.
Yeah, I'm sure with that G1000.
Yeah, G1000 autopilot takes all the fun out of it.
Well, we'd like to talk about passive investing today in real estate syndication. What the heck is syndication? We get a lot of questions about this. It's something that Ryan and I are deep into. We've been in it for a long time, and it's an investment space that I wholeheartedly believe in. There are some pros and cons. We're going to get into that. And there's some interesting things around the structure of how these investment products work. But at the end of the day, I think it's something that really serves pilots well to be aware of and to know that they're out there as something that they can participate in. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think people think about passive investing and they think, oh, if I buy a rental property, you know, I can hire a property manager and that's a passive investment. But in the eyes of the IRS, you know, they're absolutely right. But in the reality of our day-to-day, I feel like if you own the property and you're on title and you're the sole person that's managing it, you know, to me, that's not very passive because, you know, you still get the calls, you still have to make the decisions, you still have to sign on the mortgage if you take any debt. And it's really not passive in my mind. You know, I've owned, and likewise, you've owned rental properties, and we're still called to the carpet to make decisions. And, you know, in the day-to-day lives, if you have kids or, you know, just flying the line, busy, trying to have a good time, you know, those decisions get in your way of your daily life. And sometimes it requires you to go to the property. Sometimes it requires you to find a new lender or a new property manager. And man, let me tell you how much fun it is to go from Seattle to Philadelphia to mess around with a rental property on a day off.
Yeah, I'm dealing with it right now. I have a multifamily property in South Carolina, and I have to shop a new insurance policy because it's gone from $1,500 or something like that a month up to $4,000. And now they're requiring all the tenants to have liability insurance. And I have a property manager, and I'm dealing with this for hours a week with this insurance thing and trying to figure out how the property manager is going to get the tenants on you know, liability insurance. And it is it's anything but passive. So this is why, so about 7 years ago, I took a hard left turn and found syndications, and I've never looked back.
I think that's what really begs, like, you know, what is truly passive? And, you know, we can talk about all the different things, but, you know, I think that's where, if you don't want to be managing the day-to-day and you don't want to be doing the work that might be required, you know, syndication might be a perfect thing for you to take a look at. There's other types of real estate that you can get into that is passive. You know, syndication is a great tool for someone who's looking to really be like set it and forget it. And but there's also some downsides, and you know, I want to cover the downside as well, you know, on the show today.
Absolutely. So before we get into the downside, let's talk about structure. So what is a syndication, Ryan?
Well, a syndication, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's just a bunch of people coming together that are passive and investing, pooling capital together to go buy property, real property. And so usually that means that they invest as limited partners or LPs, and they're investing in a limited partnership interest in an LLC that will actually take title on the property. So effectively, you're not really even investing directly in the real estate. You're investing indirectly onto an entity that owns the asset. And there's typically a partner involved. They're called a GP or a general partner who's going to be doing all the work, all the things that we just talked about, you know, just making decisions on insurance and property taxes, operations, flying to see the property. and doing the things that maybe you're not very interested in doing, or maybe you're not skilled in doing. And so that essentially is what makes up a syndication, just a bunch of people getting together and pooling capital. And usually that GP that is running the business will find all the investors and arrange all the investors to come together to do the investment.
Right. They're putting together the equity, which is the money that's coming from investors. They're also putting together the debt, negotiating the property and putting it on a contract and actually acquiring it. And they do all the work, which is why I was so attracted to this style of investing. I really think that a great analogy is a commercial flight. You know, you can go out, you can buy a 152 and you can fly it from LA to New York, but there's a more efficient way to get there, which is buy a ticket on a commercial airliner and you can sit in the back and sleep. And so you kind of think of all the airline passengers that are in the back as LPs, as limited partners, and the flight crew and the dispatcher and the whole organization of the airline as the GP team. Are they the ones that are, you know, deciding what route to fly, and you decide whether you want to get on that airplane or not, or whether it's a safe airplane to get on. Of course, there are risks no matter what, but some airplanes are safer to get on than others, and we'll get into that.
Yeah, great analogy. The other thing you brought up, which I think is really important, is the debt. Because if you're doing your own deal, you're probably signing on your own debt, which means you're going to carry all that liability,
right,
in addition to the equity that you put into the deal. So, you know, let's say you buy a rental property for $1 million and you're putting down $500,000 of your own money. Well, chances are you're going to take a loan and you're going to be responsible for that $500,000 of debt that you put on the asset. So you're not just risking your equity, you're risking your equity plus the debt. And so when you invest, right, in a syndication, usually the operator or the GP is going to be taking on the accountability of the debt. Sometimes they might get a non-recourse loan, but for the most part, many times they'll get a recourse loan.
Let's break that down. What's the difference between a recourse and non-recourse loan?
Yeah, I really love this. So typically recourse, there's lots of scalability to recourse. So recourse can be limited and it can be unlimited, meaning that the recourse might be limited to just the property. And so if the property goes into foreclosure or somebody doesn't make a payment on it, the bank can come in and they can take the property back and go to 100% recourse, which means that they're going to take the property back. And that usually means that they're going to take out all the equity that was put up for the property until they're made whole. And, or they might go a little bit further than that and actually go for the personal guarantee that's on the loan. Maybe you, the investor that signed on the debt, if it's recourse. And sometimes there's unlimited guarantees on loans, which you got to be really careful of, which means you could go beyond the property itself in order to recoup the money that's been potentially put at jeopardy by the bank. So that means they could come after your house, they could come after your personal assets. It could get pretty gnarly. A non-recourse loan basically means that you don't have any personal liability necessarily financially. So if the property fails, you might be able to walk away free and clear from any personal obligation. So you see this a lot in Fannie and Freddie Mac loans with multifamily. Bigger projects, projects that are more stabilized, you might get a non-recourse loan. The thing to think about, though, with non-recourse is they have this thing called bad boy carve-outs, which is just a fancy way of saying that there's a list of things where if the operator acts in bad faith or does something negligent, they could trip the bad boy carve-outs, and that would mean that they would then become liable for those loans. So I know we're way off into the weeds, but...
No, this is good.
Yeah, it does kind of highlight the fact that, you know, when you're getting into a syndication, you know, just understand the players on the field, right? These guys may or may not be taking, or gals may be taking debt that is recourse or non-recourse. They're assuming that liability. They're going out finding that debt for you. You might only be investing $50,000 or $100,000 in syndication, and they're going out and finding the other, you know, $4, $5, $10, $20 million that's required to do the deal. And then you get the benefit from their professional management on the asset.
Before we leave recourse and non-recourse, I just want to step on that again, because the way that I think about this, and just to clarify for listeners if they're still not quite getting it, is that when you get a recourse loan, it's like when you're buying a house, right? The bank doesn't care about the house. They care about you. They're looking at your tax returns, your income, your ability to pay that loan back. And if you stop paying it, they're going to take back the house. But if the house isn't worth enough to pay them back what they're owed, they're going to come after you personally. And then on the non-recourse side, you know, alluding to what you're saying, you know, if you're buying a $20+ million property, the bank doesn't really care about, you know, you and your financial picture on the GP side. They're looking more at the deal. They want to see that the deal can support itself And that's where they're willing to offer what's called that non-recourse loan, where they're saying, hey, if this goes south, we're going to take back the property. But as long as there was no fraudulent or negligent activity here, that's going to be the end of it. We're not going to come after you if there's additional money that we lost out on as the bank, that the asset isn't sufficient to cover. You're going to give the keys back to the bank, and that's going to be it. Would you agree with that? Just for a clarification.
Yeah, and I think it necessarily, you know, because there's some deals that, you know, all deals the banks look at are going to have to be signed off, and the deal has right. to kind of stand on itself. I think when you think about, you know, and the borrower in all cases has to be qualified for that loan, that usually means, this is another good point too, which I'm glad we're talking about debt, because, you know, you the investor not going out and having to get the debt is a big freaking deal.
Yeah.
Because if it's a $20 million loan, that usually means that the borrower has to have 100% of the loan value and net worth. So that would mean you'd have to be worth $20 million to get that loan. And typically you have to have 10% of the liquidity of the loan amount. So that means that you'd have to have about $2 million in the bank. And so, you know, when you think about, you know, hey, I want to go buy a $20 million property. If you don't have $20 million in net worth and $2 million of liquidity, the bank's going to look at you as, you know, probably not somebody who only by themselves can get the loan. You probably have to go out and find another person to co-sign on that loan, and you become a co-signer. So there's actually quite a bit of opportunities out there where if you do have good net worth and liquidity, that means that you could become a co-signer and get actual credit in the deal or ownership in the deal for just being a guarantor in a syndication. And a lot of people do,
just for signing on the loan.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people, and I know many, many people that do that, because, you know, these loans are sometimes $60, $70, $80 million in syndication, and they may not have that net worth and liquidity. The other thing the bank's going to look at too is your experience. You know, they're not going to just hand the keys to a $60 million property if you don't have the experience to sign on the loan. So sometimes you hear the word KP or key principal, you know, GP, yep. the general partner, whatever it might be. There might be a list of people in the syndication. And sometimes there's a, you know, co-pilot, for lack of a better term, where, you know, hey, the captain maybe have a lot of experience and be seasoned on the aircraft, is flying with somebody less experienced. Maybe think of it as a line check airman, student pilot, you know, kind of pilot and training scenario, where, you know, you've got the more seasoned GP and the KP is kind of coming along for the ride and getting the experience. And that way the KP on the next deal, they might be able to get that loan all by themselves, the GP, because they have the experience of doing a deal previously. So, you know, all in all, you know, just make sure that, you know, like Tate alluded to in that analogy, don't make sure you're getting on an airplane that has the range to go across the country and has the pilots and the experience to do it. You know, my caution is always be leery of the student pilot deals, because there's student pilot deals all the time. You know, somebody goes and takes a crash course, you know, in multifamily investing, you know, they learn how to raise money a little bit, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, they're raising their money for their first deal, and they have no experience, they have no team, you know, they maybe just grab random people in the mentorship program to be their co-signer. Those deals can be, they can be lucrative, but, you know, I kind of call those magician deals, where if it works out, it's probably because they got lucky, not because they have a team that, you know, is super well versed in operations and experience. So,
and not to knock anyone, but, you know, we've seen that quite a bit in the last decade, because, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships, and it has masked the naivety of a lot of, you know, student pilots out there. And that came to a head a couple of years ago with the interest rate rise. And there's a lot of deals that are on the rocks right now.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to bring up, which is, you know, you probably, if you're doing your due diligence on what the heck a syndication is, you know, I saw a couple of posts about this, you know, you're going to be poking around and you're going to hear the good, bad, and the ugly. You're going to hear a lot of ugly right now, because there's a lot of people that, you know, not a lot of people, but there's some deals that were probably good deals and well underwritten. But as soon as the Fed started raising rates, you know, the deal didn't support the rising interest rate environment. And very quickly, some of these deals went bad. And so you have to know in a syndication that, you know, you can lose your money. You can lose all your money, just like any investing that you do. And I think it's important for people to understand that going in. Is, you know, things could look very rosy at the beginning when you look at the offering memorandum. That's the little prospectus that you look at, you know, and there's lots of projections and things that, you know, if it all goes well, you do great. But there also have been deals that are subject to external factors that have caused people to turn in the keys to deals and a complete equity loss. Nobody is completely protected from that. Nobody is. And no investment is completely safe. It's just something to be aware of.
Yep. Well, I think it's important to take a step back as well when you're looking at real estate as a cyclical industry. And instead of trying to time the market, to spend time in the market. And I think I've said this on the show before, the wrong way to invest in real estate is to try it once. And if it doesn't go well, just say, well, that didn't work. It's a long game, and real estate has a very high probability of success if you stay in it for the long run. But I think it's important to be investing in all parts of the market cycle, because you really, no one has a crystal ball. But you can certainly see where there are times where there are headwinds and tailwinds. So in any case, let's get into, I think we kind of covered the nuts and bolts. Should we get into pros, cons?
Yeah. I'd love to start with the cons, right? We're all pilots. We want to hear the risks, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What are the downsides?
So let's just dive into that. So I would say here are your top five downsides. First of all, if you get into a syndication, you have to know that it's completely illiquid. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be illiquid. So, if you've got $100,000 and you want to invest it in a syndication, well, guess what? You're not going to get that money back. Most syndications do not offer any liquidity. So just know that the money that you're investing, A, you'll want to be able to know that you could completely lose that money and it won't make a difference in your life. And two, you've got to be able to part with that money because, there's no guarantees of liquidity. And there's some funds out there, again, that are open-ended funds, but they're very rare. Typical syndications have a 3 to 7 year time frame, and they're going to involve buying property, repositioning the property to raise rents and increase operations. And then within 3 to 7 years, the operator will likely either refinance that property and send your money back, or they'll sell the property. And that's how you'll be given your money back. But in the interim, it's really out of your control. And the timing is out of your control to get that money back. So just know that it's illiquid. Now, if you invest in an open-ended fund, there's some debt funds out there that maybe offer redemption period. But check the disclaimers on that, because, typically.
Yeah. If there's a run, they might not be able to give it back.
Exactly. And there's going to be all kinds of disclosures and disclaimers in their agreements buried in the PPM that say, hey, we offer this redemption, except when we don't and we don't have the money available. Right. So, just kind of go in assuming that the money's illiquid and that you could have it tied up.
Absolutely. Just real quick, I think of it like the down payment on an investment property. That money's tied up in the property. So until you sell it, it's stuck there. It's in the house, right? And it's the exact same thing as if you were investing actively. Now, because you're a passenger on the airplane, you got to think of it from the pilot's perspective. The pilots are going to be doing the best that they can to guide that aircraft safely to its intended destination. And if they run into a wall of thunderstorms and take a deviation, the passengers have to understand that it's in the best interest for them and for the general partners, because when the general partners make money, the investors make money and vice versa. So everyone's kind of on that same ship. So just something to understand in terms of the illiquidity, that if the market conditions change, a deal could hold longer because it's in the best interest of everyone. And that's a decision that's being made by the general partnership team. So I just wanted to put a pin in that.
Yeah. And the next thing, the number two thing is it might delay your tax return. You might take great pride in getting your 1040, getting your airline W-2 in January and getting all of your things together, and then having your tax return done maybe in the February, March timeframe. When you get into a syndication, you kind of take that out of your control. It's very possible that the operator doesn't give you your tax return until August or September. So you might be filing an extension. When you get into this type of investing, you're investing in partnerships, and partnership creates a 1065, and then you get a K-1 typically, and that K-1 could take a few months after the deadline to get into your hands. So if you're going to invest in a syndication, I would just go ahead and assume that you're going to have to extend your taxes. Now, extending your taxes doesn't cost you anything. Sometimes, so there's some things that I want you to talk about there too. You have a big profitable year in your investing world, and you extend your taxes. Just remember, you've got to make estimated quarterly payments. And if you don't make estimated quarterly payments, you're going to get penalized on the money that you didn't make your estimated quarterly payments on. So just be aware, have your CPA in your back pocket, make sure that they know that you are in a syndication and that likely your K-1 is going to be delayed beyond the April filing date that you have. I would just go ahead and, you know, if you set your expectation right, then when you get your K-1 in March, you'll be like, oh, cool, they got it to me, you know, relatively early. Let's go ahead. I didn't use the word on time on purpose, because on time doesn't necessarily mean March. It could, on time to the operator could mean, you know, July or August. And it's just something that goes along with it. You know, we strive to get all of our K-1s out at the March timeframe, but again, there's so many different tax codes that change. There's things that pop up. You know, there's circumstances with the CPA that could result in your K-1 getting delayed beyond March. So just something to think about. The next thing I wanted to talk about, and I kind of alluded to this in the illiquidity event, but you have no control. You know, you can't just go barge into the flight deck and and tell the pilots what altitude to fly at, right? They might entertain something, but ultimately you're not in the flight deck. You're not flying the plane. You're a passenger. You're not in control. There really is no, I mean, there might be voting rights described in the operating agreement, but you're such a small fraction of the investment control in a situation like that. You're not going to have really many, if any, voting rights. And you really can't control when they buy and sell or refinance the property. You really can't control anything that happens. So if you're, this comes with, you know, what we talked about earlier, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you don't have to make the decisions all the time, and you don't have to be at the wheel all the time, but you know, it's really out of your control. So it's just something to think about. The next thing is potential lower upside. So I put a big asterisk next to this. So, you know, usually when you do your own deal, you put up all the money, you take on all the debt. And so naturally, if you're going to do that, I would make sure that your return is going to be better, right? Because there's a phantom or a stealth cost to doing your own deal, which is your own time, right? And your time has value. So if you do your own deal, and I would expect you to make a lot more than a syndication. And if you're not, then you're probably not valuing your time correctly. So, you know, think of it this way. If you go out and buy a rental property, some people think, oh, well, I just spend a couple hours a month on that. But think of the time that you had to spend on finding that rental property, financing it, putting a property manager in place, inspecting the asset, any repairs that needed to go into it up front. Like, you've got to think about all the time that you're spending on it, something, and how it impacts your overall upside potential. You know, a syndication might be a lower overall projected return, but think about the time savings you get from it. But just know that, you know, it would be natural to expect a syndication where you're sharing in the profits to be lower than something that you do on your own.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the last, you know, one that I kind of wanted to point out, and this is probably the point of our entire podcast, Tate, is, you know, to kind of help people do this, but you don't know how to vet. Like, you don't know how to find a syndication. You don't know how to vet a syndication. You don't know, you know, if you're getting on an airplane with a pilot with no experience or a pilot with a lot of experience, You don't know how to see behind the curtain to see if they have a dispatch team and a world-class maintenance department that's going to make sure the plane is neat and tidy and up to spec. So, you know, that is a big thing. And you know, I always tell people, don't swing at the first pitch. Get to know some syndicates, get on their lists, watch the deals go by, talk to their team multiple times. Ask some questions, find your own referrals, you know, find people that have invested with them. But really, you know, that could be a downside, is you don't, you know, that's okay, this is great, I don't want to do my own deal, I want to find my own syndication, but you really don't know how to vet the person. And I would say we'd like to offer some guidance on that on this call. But, you know, there isn't really a one size fits all approach to that. And that's, you know, something so that could be a downside. Hey, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, it's such a good list of cons. I think it's you know, you want to go into this stuff eyes wide open. You know, Ryan and I have both had terrible experiences investing in syndications. It didn't stop us from continuing to do so, but we've had some really bad ones. I mean, I've lost all my money in a ground up development deal. It was back when I didn't know how to vet. I didn't know how to vet the team. I swung it at a pitch, and I didn't really understand the context within it. I would definitely, one piece of advice I would give new investors is, when you're talking to the general partnership team and you're trying to get a sense for, you know, should I place my money with them, it should make sense. You know, one of the mistakes that I made in that deal that I lost all my money was, you know, I asked questions and I got an answer and it didn't make full sense to me. And had I just continued to ask questions and pick at that scab for long enough, I think it would have become clear that you know, this team didn't know what they were talking about. So if you just continue asking questions and you don't stop until it makes sense, it's like, hey, explain this to me like I'm a 5-year-old. Because if you keep doing that, you're going to finally get to a place where you either understand it or you don't understand it. And at that point, personally, I would walk away.
Yeah. And it's not to say, I mean, you know, we both had syndications go poorly, but we've also had some syndications go really, really well.
Absolutely.
And again, I mean, this is like any investing, right? Like, how many people have lost money in the stock market? Like, I know I have, and I've also made money in the stock market.
Crypto.
Yeah, crypto. I mean, I think that's the point that I, you know, definitely in the last decade or so of doing this, it's like, this is just investing. That's all it is. It's just another tool. It's another tool. It's another way that people get out there and get invested in real estate. And it comes with a lot of advantages and benefits. But yeah, I think, like Tate said, it's like being in the airplane. It's like, you know, I really just don't feel comfortable with this approach. And you don't really know why. Maybe you feel rushed. Maybe you feel like you just don't understand the big picture. That same feeling you're going to have in investing, and that's okay. And I think asking those questions and to the point where, like you said, you feel comfortable, almost letting the operator kind of educate you a little bit, and just even though know that you're going to go around or you're going to break it off or you're not going to actually do it, but you're just going to kind of tease it out and then maybe come back for the next one and think about doing the deal itself. My litmus test for syndications is always, and I know this is, I don't know, this is like a good idea or a bad idea, but if you can find the operator on Google and they have a few reviews and they have a team beyond just them, that's usually a good sign, right? Like if you have a reputation to lose on the internet at a minimum, you know, and look, read the tea leaves, right? If they've got 10 complaints about non-payment of contractors and, you know, they've got a couple of stars and a couple of investors, you know, a handful of investors on there saying things like, this guy disappeared with my money and whatever it might be, or they're changing the name of their company every couple of years.
Yeah.
That's probably, ask me how I know. And there's nothing wrong. I mean, you know, we have the ability to kind of get around the country fairly easily without much stress compared to most people. Go meet the person. Go walk the project. And, you know, you might not have time, but it's a good idea to check it out. I mean, I've actually had some larger investors where, you know, we've flown them down to the property and said, hey, go meet our regional manager and go walk the property itself and taste it, touch it, feel it, like ask questions, get really comfortable with what you're doing. And that's good. But for crying out loud, make sure you just put the person in Google. Right. Like that's, you know, step one, just make sure that, you know, you've Googled the person and you haven't found a million things. And also don't be afraid if somebody's gotten a couple of dings and dents. I mean, that's kind of a sign that they've been through stuff. I mean, somebody who's got no, like, it's like a private pilot. It's like, I haven't failed a single check ride. It's like, well, you've only taken one check ride.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's got a PSAP report, right? If they've been in the airlines long enough. So yeah, that's totally, that's not a big deal. You want to see a track record.
Yeah. And yeah, track record is, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, home run on every deal they've ever done. You know, track record, you know, it means they've got a track record.
I think it's better if every deal hasn't been a home run and that there has been some deals that have not gone swimmingly, because what do we say? It's like you either succeed or you learn, and you want to be with a GP team that has learned, you know, a few things after stumbling.
Yeah, and how they handled it and how they responded is huge.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff. I really like what you said, Tate, about, you know, making sure it makes sense to you, because I think there's a lot of things out there like, oh, here's 85 questions you should ask your sponsor before investing. And it's like that those are probably really great questions, but the problem is you don't really know what makes a great answer, and the questions could be just confusing you more when you're really just trying to get your arms around what's going on and how it works. Here's the other thing: building mutual trust and respect, you should never feel pressured ever.
Oh, absolutely.
any reason whatsoever. Like, there is not a once in a lifetime deal ever. There is always another deal. And it's like airline accidents. Well, we got a lot of analogies today, like airline accidents, right? The sun is always shining the day after the accident, right? You don't have to go. Like, you don't have to make this flight. If it's not safe, you don't go. And, you know, if you feel that pressure of, oh, you got to sign here and you got to do the deal and, you know, this is going to be here today and gone tomorrow, like, that's a really telltale sign of run. Like, just, yep. There's never any pressure to do anything. And try not to put that pressure on yourself. Even if you feel bad, like, man, I feel like I asked the guy a lot of questions and we had a few phone calls and, you know, I feel like I've spent, you know, time. That's the syndicator's job, is to answer your questions and go through all that. So don't feel bad about that stuff.
Part of raising capital.
Exactly. Tay, what other things do you like about him?
So I want to go through, we kind of talked about this before the show. Ryan was going to go through the cons. I was going to talk about the pros. So let's go through the list. Busy professionals don't have time to manage their own properties. We see this all the time where, hey, I'll be talking to someone and they're like, dude, I've got 3 kids. I'm running around soccer practice. There's no way that I can manage, you know, fly to some other city to look at duplexes on my days off. There's just no way, right? So how do you get real estate exposure? Because real estate is a fantastic asset class. It's tax efficient. It gives passive cash flow. It makes money in 4 different ways, which is, you know, cash flow, amortization, depreciation, and appreciation, right? It's amazing, but it can be very difficult to get into it if you don't have the time and the education. So access without your putting in an inordinate amount of your own time and a very large chunk of your own money, because you can get into a syndication with a $50,000 minimum versus, you know, there's not a whole lot of places in the U.S. now where you can buy a rental house with only $50,000 down, right? So that's one. You want to
totally
touch on anything before I move on?
No, I think you nailed it. I think, you know, when you think about getting into real estate, it's got tax benefits, big time tax benefits. You know, I think when people say, well, why would I even bother with this? I can make, you know, if I'm looking at this real estate syndication, it says it pays 16% in the stock, you know, the S&P over the last, you know, decade has been 16%. Why would I choose this one over that one? If they're looking at something apples to apples, like to compare a return, you know, the difference is, A, you're getting diversification, but B, that stock doesn't come with the tax benefits that you're going to get from real estate investing. And so by being in a syndication, it kind of couples the tax benefits with the ability to be completely passive. So just something to think about. I mean, you know, people are like, well, why would I even do this in the first place? Well, some of the most marquee, you know, endowments in the world, you know, 20-30% of their holdings are in these real estate syndications. And, you know, some of the wealthiest people I know are investing in these things. So as a diversification strategy, and, you know, it's a nice way to get into markets and get into things that you can kind of touch and feel that aren't subject to speculation. Like we talked about in our last episode about REITs.
Absolutely. Yep. You know, I talk all the time about how pilots on accident end up very stock market heavy because we have such generous 401ks. So if you aren't out there buying up rental property, you're going to end up just by the fact that your 401k is going to grow massively over your career, you're going to just be really stock market heavy. And it's a good idea to add some real estate to your portfolio purely for diversification of asset classes, right? Speaking of diversification, one of the wonderful things about syndication is that you can diversify across many different asset classes within commercial real estate and geographies. What I mean by that is, you know, if I know how to go out and buy duplexes, triplexes, maybe I'd move up into some multifamily. I'm getting the hang of this thing. I know multifamily. But then I say, hey, I want to diversify into some self-storage. I don't know the first thing about self-storage, at least to a level that I can feel confident going out and buying a self-storage facility on my own. Industrial, retail, the list goes on and on of different asset classes that you can participate in, which have different characteristics in terms of cash flow, appreciation, tax benefits. Mobile home parks, hugely beneficial for cash flow and for tax benefits. But you haven't developed that experience level in mobile home parks. You know multifamily. It's a way that you can diversify across all these different things under the sun within real estate, and then different geographies. You can have, you know, if you live in Seattle, Ryan, you wanted to invest in a property in Florida, it's going to be difficult to manage that, right? And let's say you have one in Florida, one in Texas, one in Nebraska, one in Wyoming. it starts to get really difficult to handle all of these properties all over the place. And syndication allows for a very easy way to just diversify over time across all this stuff.
So yeah, I think what makes diversification across different asset class types so appealing is that, you know, you can read in the paper and you can do your own research on kind of emerging asset classes that you might like. Like you might think that retail is good, or office, or mobile home parks, or self-storage. And it's a way for you to get direct access to that type of real estate without having to become an industry knowledge expert on something, or live in a certain market, or find a certain deal. So I think it really helps, with that strategy. And I think investors can really benefit from that. So I think that's well stated.
So the next pro on my list is the ability to go beyond your maximum bandwidth in terms of management. So I'll transition from the pilot that says, hey, I have three kids, there's no freaking way I can invest in real estate because I'm too busy. There are other investors who invest in syndications, pilots who invest in syndications, who might have we have an investor who has 12 investment properties, has built an incredible portfolio of rental properties. But, you know, I'm on the phone and she goes, I don't want a 13th. I'm at my absolute wit's end. It's already too much to manage, and I don't want to grow my portfolio even more. So eventually, if you're doing your own deals, you're going to reach that point. And maybe you can hire a VA, or maybe you can really build it. But at that point, you have a business. You know, you have a business and you've employed yourself within your own business, which is totally fine. But you're going to max out at some point. And so it's a great way to scale your real estate portfolio without scaling your real estate headaches. So that's one that I really can't state enough and why I love it so much.
And I call those accidental landlords or tired landlords, right? So like accidental landlords are people who inherit property, or, you know, maybe they did different military bases, they picked up a rental property, you know, one at a time, and they just never sold the houses. Or, you know, they're tired, like you're saying, you know, they have 12 rental properties. And what's really cool about having a bunch of rental properties that you don't want is I literally just helped a pilot dispose of some rental property and 1031 exchanged it into a syndication. Now, that's a whole nother episode. And I have a lot of opinions, very strong opinions on how to do that correctly. But there is a way out. You know, give us a call and we can talk to you about that. You know, Tate and I are very experienced in
absolutely
helping investors get out of rental property and get into something more passive. So
there are also tired landlords at the $20 million level. And we find those, right? That brings me to the next one is the syndicators are finding better deals than you are. And what I mean by that is, you know, I went to a real estate conference many, many years ago now, and my goal was to grow my real estate network and to continue buying my own properties. And instead, I found the airline pilots of real estate, and I realized that, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. Sometimes that statement can be very helpful when you just realize, you know what, instead of going out and flying my 152 on the weekend, I'm just going to buy a ticket. Let the professionals do it. This is what they do day in, day out, versus being that weekend warrior that kind of dabbles in real estate or does it semi-effectively. When I say that they're finding better deals than you, this is what I mean. I met a syndication team that had a six person just on the acquisitions team. It's a large company. Six people were just working in acquisitions. They're cold calling potential sellers. They are taking brokers to lunch. They know every lender, every broker in the market, and they're schmoozing and cold calling. They're doing all of these things 5 days a week. And it's like, I can't compete with that. If I'm looking at a triplex deal or a 16 unit apartment complex, it's already been picked over by professionals. And a lot of times the smaller stuff, you know, doesn't have the economies of scale, but that's kind of a different topic. But, you know, I realize that I'm looking at scraps. You know, there's a joke that LoopNet is where deals go to die. LoopNet, if you're not familiar, is kind of like Zillow or Redfin for commercial real estate. And it's so true because the good deals get done off market by relationships. People that have relationships with brokers, with potential sellers, and those deals get done before that property even hits the market. So if you can't beat them, join them. It's like, you know what? These guys are getting amazing deals under contract. And then they're able to get debt at better terms than I would be able to personally as well. If I go to the bank and they're like, well, okay, your experience is X and you're going after this, where, you know, the best we can do is a 7% interest rate, they might be able to get financing at 5.5, which means they can pay more for the same prop rate and make more profit out of it once they own it. So that's a huge benefit to me.
Yeah, totally. And I think getting a better deal, and then also you're probably going to make more money because your splits in a syndication are probably going to be favorable to you, the investor.
And that was the next one on my list, which is investors keep most of the profits. Yeah. Investors are at least on a 50-50 from what, you know, all the hundreds and hundreds of deals that I've looked at.
I think you nailed it. And I, you know, having a preferred return is a big deal. So you're going to have some kind of preference, which basically is just a fancy way of saying you're going to get paid first as the LP or the limited partner. But as the investor, let's say you put in $100,000, you know, the typical preferred return could be anywhere from 6 to 14%. But let's just say it's 8% for this example. That means that based on your investment amount, you're going to accrue $8,000 annually in a preferred return account balance. So that gets paid to you first before any splits with the general partner who's actually running the deal. So once that's satisfied, then it might go to, like Tate said, to a 50-50 or a 70-30 or an 80-20 or a 90-10, whatever it might be. But that means that you're going to get that 100% preference first before there's any splits with the sponsor as well. So,
and then it's favorable to you after the fact. So, hey, I'll take 70% of the deal any day for doing none of the work. And, you know, because of the incredible experience of a lot of these teams that are really good at what they do and they rinse and repeat, the value creation is massive, what they're able to accomplish in a 3 to 5, 3 to 7 year period. I will bring up one thing here, and that is that I get questions from investors sometimes that says, they'll say, why don't you just keep it? Like, okay, we buy a property that's you know, maybe not distressed, but that is suboptimal. And we optimize it through physical improvements, through operationally improving it, increase the net operating income, cash flow increases. Why do you sell it? Well, the answer there is usually because the value has now been created. We did the job. We got to our destination. And it makes sense to get off the ride now and then get back, you know, use that capital to buy something else and participate in that value creation once again. So usually that's why these deals end up, we buy, we renovate, increase rents, we improve the property, and then we sell, give you your money back, plus returns. And it's up to you if you want to participate in the next 3 to 5 years of value creation somewhere else.
Yeah, totally. And I think that ties into, you know, a great question you should ask your operator. And by the way, I use the word operator interchangeably with general partner, interchangeably with sponsor. So these are the people that you're talking to that are running the deal. And I always ask, like, what is the exit strategy for the investment? And, you know, if I just hear one singular exit strategy, I get a little bit turned off, because you should have multiple exit strategies always. You should always have, you know, hey, we can sell it. We can refinance it. We can reposition it into a different use. Whatever it might be to exit, you want to have that. And, you know, I always ask the operator, you know, hey, how many years on average does it take you to sell property? Have you ever gone longer? Have you ever gone shorter? I ask those questions just to kind of get a sense of the operator's ability to kind of make buy sell decisions on, you know, buying and selling the property. Because the worst thing you want them to do is be a seller when the market's down or be a buyer when the market is up, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of on you to analyze that. But once the property is purchased, you want to make sure they have good decision-making ability on when, you know, a good time to dispose of the asset. And again, you know, trapped equity is a real thing that, you know, Tate's talking about, where, you know, hey, we've built up all this equity in the property. It's time to let it go. It's time to harvest that equity and do something else with it that we can make more money on. So good points.
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot of that today because interest rates are high. And even though we have all this trapped equity and a lot of deals today, you know, there's some are distressed, but the deals that are going well, it doesn't really make sense to sell them right now. And so we see a lot of deals that are just sort of sitting there. And we're sort of collecting cash flow and we're waiting for know, the skies to clear for rates to come down slightly, and then it'll make more sense to sell those and harvest. The last one I'm going to touch on is the snowball effect over time. So something that I built a syndication returns calculator because I was genuinely curious, you know, years ago when I started investing in these deals, what does it look like over time if I just keep doing a $50,000 investment or $100,000 investment every year for the next 10, 15, 20, 25 years? And the results were astonishing because, you know, the first few years, I built this because the first few years are very boring. Typically, syndication deals only throw off either nothing or maybe 5% cash flow. And that few hundred dollars that's landing in your account every month or a quarter isn't going to change your life. So you invest $100K, the next year you invest another $100K, the next year you invest another $100K. And most of these deals are going to take 5 years to mature. And you're going to be 4 years in, like, man, I put almost $500,000 in this, and it's really not doing much. But then you get your first exit. You get your first deal that goes full cycle. You get all your cash back, plus that return on sale. And it's like, whoa, that's nice. And then guess what? The next year, another one comes. And next year, another one comes. And now you have this flywheel of cash that's coming back to you. Then you're redeploying into new deals that's providing fresh depreciation losses that you can offset the gains with. It's just, it's incredible once you plant the seeds. And it just takes a number of years getting that initial capital invested in these kinds of deals before you really start seeing some exciting progress.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a really good point. And the other thing that I want to conclude on, I think, is expectations, right? So you make the investment in a syndication. So let's say you find the operator, you have a good conversation, and you say, screw it, I'm going to try it. 50K, go into a deal. What can you expect going forward? What is the bond that is created, the social bond that's created between you and the operators, like I like to refer it? You know, yeah. You've given up all your control, you've given them your money, you know, you're kind of along for the ride. It's like there's still expectations that you should minimally expect. And that's number one is communication. You should expect to hear from your operator on some kind of frequency, usually quarterly or monthly. You should be getting some kind of report. And that report should, you know, generally have some things in it, such as like property performance data, maybe a brief summary. It doesn't have to be a long dissertation every single month on the property, but, you know, a brief summary on what's going on. You should be communicated to about the operator thinking about selling or buying, you know, or making improvements to the property. You should, you know, expect to see a picture or two here and there. Now, you're not going to hear about every little bump in the property, right? You're not going to hear about, oh, you know, this happened today or that happened today or, you know, things like that. You're not going to hear that, those small little details, but you should expect to hear big changes to the property. So for example, we've had a property wiped out in a tornado. You'd probably want to hear about that within 24 to 48 hours, right? But, you know, something like a car bumped into the building. Yeah, that happens. You know, probably I, you know, it really is meaningless financially. Maybe there's an insurance claim, but you know, something like that might not really be all that important to tell the investor. And so the operator might choose not to talk to you about it. And that's okay, you know, for minor things. But, you know, as we say, you know, bad news doesn't get better with age. We want to hear from our operators when things are going poorly or when things are going well, likewise. So, you know, I would expect minimally that. And then the other thing I would expect is some kind of financial reporting, you know, a P&L or a balance sheet at some frequency that goes out that lets you know kind of the financials of the project. Tate, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think that's spot on. I think that, you know, whenever someone has a bad experience in a passive deal, it usually revolves around poor communication. There are very few times where a deal can go sideways. And if the operator is being upfront, honest, working their absolute butt off to make the deal work and communicating very clearly about what is happening and the efforts that are going into it, that investors are going to leave with a sour taste in their mouth. It's the deals that start to go sideways and the operator just disappears. They just go silent. And whether they're working behind the scenes or not, the investors have no clue what's happening with their capital. That's where, you know, people just come away from that experience really disheartened, and it makes them not want to invest again. So I think choosing an operator based on, you know, their frequency and quality of their communications is very, very important.
I agree. And if you don't like the quality of the communications, I would expect it minimally to have a phone number for someone you could to call or someone to email. And, you know, and just remember, before you get too combative with your syndicator, just remember, you know, try to have the mindset that, hey, we're on the same team here, right? Like, we're all trying to get to our destination. You know, this is the go home leg. Like, nobody's
on the same aircraft.
You're on the same plane, right? There's no reason to get combative. That's not going to help anybody. You know, if something's going wrong or you don't quite understand, you know, seek to understand before you just, you know, lay into somebody, because it might be that they're working through something, and giving you too much information sometimes is going to make it more complicated, is right. It's like giving that PA to a passenger. It's like you want to be honest and transparent, but sometimes you don't need to be so darn detailed that now you've freaked everybody out, you know, in the back when you didn't really need to. You know, and you know, everything is going to be okay. So just kind of, you know, I would have that expectation to do that. So, and know that you're entitled to inspect the operator's books, right? You're entitled to, you know, see the financial performance of the investment at any time. You know, I mean, I wouldn't ask them every day, but, you know, at some frequency, if you wanted to see the balance sheet and the P&L, like, you should feel entitled, and the operator should be organized enough to provide you with that information. And you know, that's, you know, that should be your right, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Just to add to that, I think that, you know, I get a lot of questions as well about, you know, hey, you ever heard of CrowdStreet or Cadre or Realty Mogul, or there's a lot of these crowdfunding websites. And that this was a function of the 2012 Obama Jobs Act that legalized crowdfunding. And it made a big splash back in 2012. Everybody thought, you know, these new crowdfunding platforms were really going to take over. Everybody was going to be investing in real estate via these big platforms. And it never really took off. And this is exactly why, is because when you're cutting a $50,000 or $100,000 check, it really becomes a relationship business. So just as that snowball financially grows over time, the relationship business grows over time. When you have a good experience with a great team, people tend to reinvest. And while there are hundreds, thousands of operators throughout the country in various different asset classes with varying degrees of success, track record, communication skills, and acumen, I think that there's a lot of good ones, but people tend to reinvest with the ones who they build that relationship with. And there's the trust, know, like, and trust factor, where it's like, hey, you know, I've flown this airline a bunch. I like the service. I feel comfortable with them. I know the drill. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you don't have to go chasing, you know, greener pastures at that point. So anyway, my two cents.
Finding these things and looking at lots of them will help fine tune. So those websites can be great for just kind of poking around and kind of seeing what's out there. But start to open up your lens and go to some conferences, read some books, you know, listen to podcasts, and see what syndications are out there to kind of really build your deal funnel. Well, Tate, this has been a great show. I think I feel like we really provided some overview of, you know, how to find, vet, pros, cons, ups, downs, what is it? I hope everybody kind of took away from this. If you did enjoy what you listened to, you know, throw us a comment in the Facebook forum. I think that's a great place to collaborate on this kind of stuff. And
we've been having a blast with everybody on the Facebook forum recently. Thank you for everybody that's been posting on there. Thank you. Thank you. If you're not a member yet, join up. There's been some really nice activity.
Yeah. And if you have a syndication, I mean, we obviously can't act as your like investment advisor or something, but we're always happy to give 2 cents on, you know, hey, I'm looking at this. Like, don't just say, hey, I'm looking at this. What do you think? Say, hey, I'm looking at this. Take it a step further. I'm looking at this deal and this is what I see. And this is what I think it is. Is that right? Or what do you guys agree? Or this is my expectation of what I might get in this. You know, is that right? Is that what you guys are seeing? Help kind of lead us to what you're thinking, and that'll help us give you some better feedback on where you're trying to go with something. So anyway, Tate, it's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. The end of the day, syndication's my favorite way to invest, but we'll leave it here. Thanks so much, my friend.
Talk to you the next time.